Welcome to the show, everybody. Of course, as always, and by always I mean every single time, I'm never going to stop saying this, we have a great episode for you today. We're going to get started by talking about a film style and a film style spotlight, and that's going to be German Expressionism, a really interesting style of film that really led to a lot of other interesting modern Hollywood looks, and we'll learn a little bit about that in just a few minutes. We'll have a trivia question, of course. We're going to debut a new segment called Fact or Fiction, and this is one is a lot of fun. Sam's going to present some various Hollywood stories, and we'll try and figure out if they're true or false or a little of both. We're going to have a top six list about music in non-musical movies, and we'll finish things up with a Film Buffs Dictionary segment all about the Zoom. I'm Stephen Keller.
And some people, it's a very commonly discussed story here, but some people say that I am, in fact, Sam Stoddard. Stephen, what do you think? Is that true or false, or maybe a bit of both?
I'm going to say false.
You're wrong. I am Stephen. No.
Aha! Gotcha!
Yeah. This week on Film Style Spotlight, we're going to be talking about one of the oldest artistic movements in film history. But though the movement ended way back in the 1920s, the influence is pervasive today, affecting virtually every horror movie, for example, and even movies well outside the horror genre use the same techniques to enhance their impact. What I am talking about is German Expressionism. It was a movement in Germany, obviously, that took place primarily in the 1920s, spilling a little bit into the 30s, but the basic idea of Expressionism is to distort reality and exaggerate it in order to make it reflective of the emotion or the state of mind of a character or what the audience is supposed to feel or whatever. And so if you have a character who's feeling, for example, trapped or constrained, either literally because he's in prison, or maybe figuratively because he's faced with some kind of insurmountable problem and he doesn't see a way out of a dilemma, then what you can do is maybe build your sets and set up your lighting and camera angles and stuff in order to reflect that state of mind. So rather than having a normal-sized room with nice vertical walls and horizontal ceiling and floor, instead build it so the walls lean in on you and the ceiling is unnaturally low and the windows are unnaturally small and maybe skewed and inaccessible or whatever. And if you want to reflect corruption, you could go further and actually have walls bent and twisted and the windows and doors stretched in all weird different directions and everything. That it looks unrealistic, but mirrors the emotions of the scene. That's an extreme form of expressionism where you're throwing away realism entirely, but you can be expressionistic and still be realistic as well. So you just maybe don't exaggerate things quite that much. So to film this guy who's feeling trapped, maybe he's in a small room, but a realistically small room, and you shoot the scene in a way that emphasizes this confined setting and the walls and keeping the walls and ceiling visible and kind of very close.
Right. I would say that even some very common techniques, like a point-of-view shot, is an expressionistic technique. When the camera becomes the point of view of the character, that's expressionism.
Sure.
That's sort of something that you're going to see after this movement. Hollywood films in the early 1900s would not have done that kind of thing.
Right. And you can use lighting and things, make shadows very pervasive and stark to enhance a feeling of terror. But you can also use expressionism. I think we normally think of expressionism as painting negative, dark kinds of emotions and atmospheres, but you can also go the other way. You can have brighter and happier emotions filmed in an expressionistic style. So you emphasize light and bright colors and open spaces, whatever is called for. You don't see it as much, especially early on, but it is done. Tim Burton's a great example. He's a more modern director. His movies tend to be expressionistic, almost all of them. His Batman movies are expressionistic in a very dark way, Big Fish in a lighter way. Charlie and the Chocolate Factory and Edward Scissorhands use a little bit of both to create contrast between different moods. But getting back to the beginning of this movement, in 1915, a couple of writer-directors team up to make a movie called The Golem, and they were Paul Weininger and Henrik Galeen, and I'm not sure how to pronounce that one, but this movie is considered by many to be either the first work of German Expressionism or the one that kind of triggers the movement in a few years. But it's hard to tell because this movie has unfortunately been lost. We can't see it today and really study its artistry, but it's generally credited with spawning the German Expressionism movement. And it's about this clay statue brought to life to be a servant, and eventually this creature falls in love, and when he's rejected, he winds up committing a series of murders. So right away, we see not only the beginnings of German Expressionism, but of the horror genre itself, and that will continue throughout the 1920s. In fact, in 1920, Paul Weininger made a prequel called The Golem, and sometimes you see the subtitle, The Golem, How He Came Into the World, and that movie does survive, and it is considered quite a classic. Another movie that survives today is The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari, and this is the first clear-cut work of German Expressionism, I think, is generally considered, but it's from 1920, directed by Robert Vine. It is about this mad doctor and this unnatural kind of guy that can predict the future, and there's a series of kidnappings and murders, so we see the same sorts of themes cropping up, but it all centers around this insane asylum, and there's a twist ending and everything. I mean, the movie is just loaded with unrealistic sets and bizarre lighting. The village where this movie takes place isn't supposed to look realistic at all. All these buildings are clearly sets, but they're all leaning over each other, and they're bent and twisted, and the doors and windows are very obviously painted on, but stretched and skewed in a way that is not even practical. And it works. It looks like this unnatural, oppressive place to be and to live, and that's the emotion that the story needs to draw out.
Yeah, I think it's great. The set design in this movie is so fantastic. And Expressionism, we should probably just mention real quick, was a movement in art before it got to film. Like, a lot of film styles have precursors in other artistic media, but it looks like paintings come to life, like these crazy paintings with looming buildings where no two lines meet at a 90-degree angle. Everything is crooked and twisted, and none of it looks physically possible. And it's cool because, of course, especially after you've seen the ending of Caligari, you get why, you know, oh, so it sort of is, in a way, a nightmare, maybe. It feels like something that comes out of a bad dream the whole way through.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's very well done. Of course, other movies will use the same sorts of techniques and not have that kind of slant to it, but it's still effective because these images do draw those emotions for whatever reason. I would think the next major work of Expressionism is Nosferatu in 1922, 2 years later. It's definitely considered the definitive vampire movie of all time. It's by director F.W. Murnau, probably one of the, I would say, two biggest names in German Expressionism, and he wanted to adapt Bram Stoker's Dracula, but he couldn't get the rights, so he wound up filming basically the same story with changed names. But unlike the seductive, aristocratic Dracula that we see in most portrayals of Dracula, Nosferatu is this repulsive, hunched-over kind of rat of a man with long fingernails, a very disturbing appearance, made all the more so by the way he's photographed. A famous scene shows his shadow on the wall as he climbs the stairs, and the silhouette shows his hunched back to pretty good effect, and his long fingernails curled like a claw in front of him, and the unnatural way that he moves up the stairs. You get this real sense of menace, and it doesn't look like it's very easy to defend against because he's just not real. He's unearthly in some way. And there are a number of other ways in which reality is distorted to enhance the effect. And this is obviously what Expressionism is all about, but there's a number of different techniques applied in this movie. The most memorable shot for me is when Nosferatu is rising from his coffin. The night is beginning, and so he's rising from that. And the way they do it is the actor, Max Schreck, kind of a famous name in silent film history, but he lies down on this board. You can't see the board, but he lies down on this board inside the coffin, and he just rests on it. And as the camera shoots at him directly from the front, that board is tilted upward, putting him into a standing position. So it just looks like he's pulling himself up in defiance of all gravity to rise for the night. I don't know, maybe it'll sound a little cheesy the way I'm describing it, but in the context of this movie, it's just chilling.
Yeah, absolutely. Nosferatu is a classic, and I mean, it's interesting, of course, that so many of the most famous German Expressionist films are sort of in this horror genre, kind of. Even Caligari sort of plays like a horror movie, and I think part of that has to do with the German mood. When you talk about the 1920s in Germany, of course, this is right after the German defeat in World War I. Germany has a totally destroyed economy. The country is just this oppressive, bleak mood that bleeds absolutely into its films, which is why so many of them seems so dark, and yet, as is often the case with art, this terrible circumstances produces wonderful, compelling works of art that are still kind of chilling and effective to this day.
Yes, and Murnau would go on to do three other big classics of expressionism, among other things. But The Last Laugh in 1924, Faust in 1926, and Sunrise in 1927. Of these three, Faust is the only one you consider a horror movie, though. The Last Laugh is basically a drama, and Sunrise is kind of a drama with some thriller elements. But we started to see expressionism used not just in the horror genre that I think it's primarily identified with. The Last Laugh is one of the first movies to feature a moving camera. Murnau had used it himself in previous movies, but this is one of the earliest noteworthy uses of a moving camera. And that's something we don't think of older movies being. Even decades after the 20s, we don't think of a lot of moving cameras, but here we see the innovation of these German expressionists coming up with different ways and different tools to get inside the heads of the characters.
And one interesting thing, I mean, just as a testament to Murnau's ability to use camera work to get across his message, is that The Last Laugh, of course, these are all silent films, but The Last Laugh has only one title card the entire movie. Most silent films have title cards. Dialogue is displayed, obviously, as a card on the screen. The Last Laugh does not. It only has one title card kind of at the end, and there's just some debate over whether or not that should really even be considered sort of part of the movie proper. A lot of people like to just pretend the movie ends right before that card. But, I mean, basically, he's able to convey this entire complex story of drama and emotion without any dialogue, and that's, you know, you can only do that if you are extremely careful in the way your movie looks.
Very definitely. And so moving on to Faust, a quick word about that. This movie is just laden with special effects that serve the atmosphere. So another technique that we think of it as even more modern than just a moving camera. But there's all these creatures and transformations and these big virtuoso shots of, like, there's the character Mephisto, who's this black-winged creature, and he's just hovering over this town. And he's so huge that his wings just blot out the sky, and the town is sort of relegated to this small corner of the screen, and it's just sort of huddled there underneath this humongous character, and very evocative image. Now, today, we demand that our special effects be realistic and convincing. We make fun of any movie and just kind of throw it out of consideration of any critical value if it doesn't look convincing from a special effects perspective. But the Expressionists, they didn't really care so much. They weren't interested in their sets being realistic, so why make the special effects realistic? To them, it was just another opportunity to skew reality.
Yeah, but I don't think you should short sell it. I mean, in the 1920s, these were pretty compelling special effects.
Well, absolutely, but what I'm saying is I don't think they wanted them to be realistic. I wasn't denigrating them at all. I was saying it's good that they had this attitude that rather than try to make them as realistic as possible and maybe come up short, let's not bother. Let's just try to exaggerate them and use them in ways that are not realistic, like the slanted buildings and walls and things that we see in Expressionism.
Sure. I guess I get what you're saying. I just don't want to seem like we're slamming their effects.
Yeah, okay. Good clarification.
If you think of, like, the makeup work in Nosferatu or something, I mean, it's incredible. Even today, that would be a compelling makeup job.
That's a good point, yeah.
It's great that they were able to do some of the stuff they were able to do when they had, you know, very few of the modern tricks,
right.
Tricks of the trade the special effects and makeup guys have.
That's an excellent point. Nosferatu does look like a real creature who is not at all human. Now, in Sunrise, we see expressionism used to create a very interesting kind of feeling that is realistic, I think. It's about a married man who is seduced by this other woman, and they go out on the town from one nightclub to another and have a really good time. And again, the sets, the buildings and lights and crowds of people are all distorted beyond reality, but in a different way. This is a bright place, this idealized fairy tale world where the streets and nightclubs and everything everywhere is just packed with people, and they're all laughing and dancing and enjoying themselves, and there are dazzling lights just every which way. And there's this one really interesting shot where it's a composite shot of the man and the woman walking through the town, and they just have a little portion of the screen in the middle, and all around them are these other fragments of shots merged in of other places on the town and people having fun and whatever. So it looks like they're just being engulfed by life and gaiety. And then by contrast, when the man returns home to his wife, it's this very square, very dull building on a riverbank, very realistic but dark and isolated from everything else. No lights to speak of, everything is quiet and boring and almost oppressively so. Obviously, the difference between the two places is dramatic and reflective of how the main character feels about both of those places.
Yeah, and it's interesting, too, that Sunrise is actually an American film. Murnau moves over to Hollywood at this time, and it's interesting seeing how well it translates to a more American story. It's not quite as crazy as the stuff that was happening in Germany in terms of the weird plots and the horror stuff, but yeah, it works beautifully in a more straightforward kind of story that's set in a more real universe. It's still using these techniques to give us a sense of emotion and psychological states of minds of the characters without creating a total fantasy.
Yeah, and it's really unfortunate because clearly Murnau is still at the top of his game in Sunrise, but he died in 1931, and he made one or two sound films, but nothing of real significance. So we just really have no idea what he might have done with sound once he had that tool added to his toolbox. This is really unfortunate. The other giant of German Expressionism is a guy who did survive into the sound era and continued to be prolific. He's Fritz Lang, who is primarily known for two expressionistic works, One Silent, One Sound. The silent is Metropolis, released in 1927. This is a cult favorite today still. I think one of the few silent movies that aren't comedies that people still go back to enthusiastically. General audiences, not just critics. This is one of my all-time favorite silent films, and it's the definitive dystopian nightmare story that about this super developed urban environment. It plays very much like a dream and features just one amazing image after another. It imagines a future where there's no real room for creative thought. People have become automatons and in service to the machines that they have built to run the world. The only place left for people is to be performing these rote tasks of monitoring these machines and doing maintenance. It has very much the feel of George Orwell's 1984 in terms of the feeling and the environment and the government of this place. I don't know that there's a direct influence. I would be shocked if Orwell was not influenced by this movie. But Metropolis is more or less the first of its kind, and the visuals would become the prototype for many a movie later on. It has these wild, vast, exaggerated cityscapes where the buildings are impossibly tall and the streets are impossibly long and the streets are just packed with cars and windows just are everywhere, and people inhabit not just these buildings, but this colossal underground tunnel system beneath the city with level upon level of compartmentalized machinery. Anytime you see a futuristic cityscape in a movie today, whether it's Blade Runner or The Fifth Element or Equilibrium, if you know that movie, it's drawing inspiration for the visuals from Metropolis. And there are also traces of Metropolis in King Kong and Dr. Strangelove and a few other things. Charlie Chaplin's Modern Times, where Chaplin works in this factory working on an assembly line doing these hilariously mechanical tasks. I think this is at least in part inspired by Metropolis, where we have these real spectacle shots of rows upon rows of people all tending to different units of this giant machine, and their jobs are so rhythmic and mechanical that it looks like the people are actually part of this machine, just one more moving component.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, like, you mentioned Orwell's 1984, and Metropolis really is one of the first visions of a dystopian future. When you see any dystopian movie, you know, you mentioned Blade Runner or The Fifth Element, you could add Brazil or...
Oh, yeah,
Metropolis'
that's a good
influence
one.
Just cannot be understated. It's pretty much influenced, really, like you say, every science fiction film that follows and a lot of other films we don't think of as sci-fi movies. Anytime you see that dystopian, oppressive future in a movie, you know, Metropolis got there first.
Right. I also, before we move on, I want to mention the acting in Metropolis. And I think it would be easy to mistake the acting here for a style of acting that was common in silence that we would call overacting today, these exaggerated theatrical gestures and posturing and so forth. This was common in early movies, good and bad, because people were used to the theater where the acting had to be large enough so the people at the back could see it. But here, it feels like yet another expressionistic device. If the sets are exaggerated, the special effects are exaggerated, if everything is exaggerated to create an emotional effect, why not the acting as well? So this may or may not be how people really act when you see them in this movie, but it's exactly how our feelings and imagination would manifest themselves in physical form. Fritz Lang's other expressionistic masterpiece is a sound film made in 1931. It's called M, and it's about a serial killer played by Peter Lorre. Steven, I know this is a favorite movie of yours, so I figured I'd ask you to maybe talk a bit about this.
Well, absolutely. This is my favorite work of German Expressionism, and I love it because it's probably still the definitive expressionistic use of sound. Sound is still early, still kind of experimental, and especially in Europe, where it took a little longer to get there than it did in Hollywood. Lang brilliantly uses long periods of mostly silence, or at least without a lot of dialogue, to heighten suspense. The plot of the movie is basically Laurie is this serial killer who's murdering children, and this sends everyone obviously into an uproar. The cops are all looking for the serial killer, and they start harassing the local gangsters. And so the gangsters, deciding that they need to catch this guy themselves so that the cops will let them go about their business, also begin looking for him. And Laurie is a monster, but he sort of becomes the main character throughout most of the film. Is he's like a rat trapped in a maze. Everyone's out to get him, and he has to hide in these rooms. And the movie wonderfully uses simple elements like someone breathing. We hear, and that's it on the soundtrack, as we also maybe hear footsteps walking outside the door, people looking for Laurie, and wonderful use of shadow. One of the great things that Expressionism did so well was, obviously, these were all black and white films, and it used very high contrast, lots and lots of shadows and little lights, and so you could cloak almost the entire frame in shadow, and it works to make this really tense and overbearing atmosphere. And it's amazing to me how effective of a thriller it is today. Some of these movies that we mentioned before, I think if you watch Nosferatu today, you're be impressed by it, but it's not really going to scare you. It's kind of creepy, kind of weird, and the same thing for movies like Caligari, but they're not going to scare you at all. However, M is absolutely still tense. It still feels like a fresh, modern thriller. It's also interesting, for just a couple other historical notes, it's one of the very first police procedurals in which we see the cops going through and investigating a crime and putting pieces together. And if you've seen any episode of Law and Order, you kind of know how this goes, but this is back in the 1930s where these were not all cliches. So you get to witness the birth of a lot of these very tried and true moments from films.
Fritz Lang, by the way, is particularly interesting to us because after being one of the major expressionistic filmmakers, he would later move on to Hollywood and make film noir in the 40s and 50s, including some real classics like Fury and The Woman in the Window and The Big Heat. Film noir is a huge movement that emerges in America in the 1940s, but we'll be talking about that next week. But it borrows very heavily from the techniques of expressionism, and Fritz Lang is pretty unique for having been at the forefront of both of these movements.
Yeah, and it's interesting about Expressionism is that it ends very, very suddenly in the early 30s. M is 1931, and not long after that, by about 33 or 34, of course, the Nazis have come to power in Germany, and they take over the film industry, and pretty much all of the great German filmmakers that could escape did. They left, and all of a sudden Germany produces pretty much nothing of any value until after World War II. It's kind of sad how quickly this blossoming movement ended. We didn't really get to see it experiment much with sound.
A couple other landmarks of German Expressionism are probably worth mentioning. Paul Laney and Leo Burinsky directed Waxworks in 1924, which is a frame tale where each of the three separate stories uses a different expressionistic style. And in 1929, director George Wilhelm Pabst made Pandora's Box, the definitive role for Louise Brooks, who was a real superstar at the time, and she plays this uninhibited vaudeville character who is an early femme fatale character, and it's sort of a template for that character type, which of course would become a staple of film noir later on. But before we wrap this up, I want to talk a bit about how widespread the influence of this movement was, because it was huge. Right off the bat, we start seeing the early Hollywood monster movies, Dracula and Frankenstein and the Mummy and all those. In fact, some of those movies were shot by the cinematographer Karl Freund, who also shot The Golem and The Last Laugh and Metropolis. So this is not just a case of influence, but of employing the same talents to create a different movement and bringing over the same styles. Citizen Kane, not a horror movie, not a noir, but it's as expressionistic as anything. There's this great scene that takes place inside a room, and the window on the far side looks normal-sized at first until the Kane character strolls back there to the wall. And then you realize it was this optical illusion, this trick of perspective, because the window is really this massive, towering window that utterly dwarfs Kane. Wells would go on to make The Magnificent Ambersons and Touch of Evil, also both very expressionistic, as well as some other works. We've mentioned before on this podcast how in 12 Angry Men, director Sidney Lumet uses lower and lower camera angles and longer lenses as the movie plays to increase the feeling of claustrophobia in the jury room, so it feels like the walls are just crowding in. Another expressionistic technique, but this time in a realistic courtroom drama. You can even use it for comedy. Silly personal example, maybe, but in the 1967 comic version of Casino Royale, there's this sequence in this expressionist mansion where the walls are in doors and stairs, everything are warped and crooked in the manner seen in The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari. But as this is a comedy, the scene is all about how difficult it is to climb crooked stairs without falling over. More recently, I mentioned Blade Runner and Tim Burton and Edward Scissorhands and all that. In 92, Woody Allen made the movie Shadows and Fog, which is a part homage, part spoof of Expressionism. The list goes on, and I think today the techniques of Expressionism are used pervasively throughout all kinds of filmmaking, just maybe not to obvious extremes, but again, it's just not possible to underestimate the influence of this movement. Another week, another trivia question. This week's is to identify the screenwriter of the W.C. Fields comedy The Bank Dick, who is credited under the pseudonym Mahatma Kane Jeeves. Take a guess and check back with us later in the episode to see if you're right. We've got a new segment for you called Fact or Fiction. Here's how it works. I'm going to tell the stories of a few different movie-related urban legends, these fun little anecdotes that are told and retold, but may or may not actually be true. And after each story, Stephen doesn't know it yet, but we're going to give him a little quiz on the truth of it, and you at home can guess as well.
Really? Another quiz for me, huh?
Another quiz.
Wow.
There's not enough on this show.
This is becoming a lot like school now.
Well, this week, the stories I'm going to tell all have something to do with weird little legal matters. My first story is on a famous feud between the Marx Brothers and Warner Brothers when the Marx Brothers started making their film A Night in Casablanca. Warner Brothers wrote a cease and desist letter claiming that the use of the name Casablanca in a movie violated their copyrights because, of course, Warner Brothers produced the classic Best Picture-winning film Casablanca just a few years earlier. So Groucho Marx wrote back to Warner Brothers, writing a hilariously scathing response that got leaked to the press and generated a lot of publicity for A Night in Casablanca. And it read in part, "You claim that you own Casablanca and that no one else can use that name without your permission. What about Warner Brothers? Do you own that too? You probably have the right to use the name Warner, but what about brothers? Professionally, we were brothers long before you were." Now, Jack, how about you? He's talking about Jack Warner here. "Do you maintain that yours is an original name? Well, it's not. It was used long before you were born. Offhand, I can think of two Jacks. There was the Jack of Jack and the Beanstalk and Jack the Ripper, who cut quite a figure in his day." Now, ultimately, Warner Brothers was humiliated into submission, and the Marx Brothers got to use their little title, A Night in Casablanca, after all. Now, Stephen, is this story fact, fiction, or a little of both?
I think it's a little of both. I'm pretty certain Groucho wrote the letter. I read it before, but I think, I mean, wasn't that really overplayed, the amount of legal action that Warner was actually considering? I thought
yeah.
It was mainly a stunt by the Marx Brothers.
Yeah, you're absolutely correct, and I was a little disappointed to learn this, but definitely the letter is word for word accurate. It is a letter he actually sent. However, it's not in response to what he was alleging the original Warner Brothers contact was. Warner Brothers didn't really object to the title. They heard that the Marx Brothers were going to be making a parody of Casablanca, and originally it was going to be more of an exact match, more of a real parody of Casablanca. They had characters like Humphrey Bogus and all this stuff, you know, having a very similar plot and everything. So Warner Brothers was concerned about their copyrights and asked the Marx Brothers for plot details of their film so that they could make a determination about whether or not the copyrights were being infringed. But apparently all they ever got back from Groucho Marx were letters like that one that I quoted from, and others that outlined that, you know, that pretended to answer the question but outlined these absolutely insane plot details, like how Chico works as a sponge salesman in a saloon to people who can't hold their liquor, and Harpo plays this Arabian caddy who lives in a small Grecian urn outside of the city, stuff like that. So Warner Brothers just ultimately gave up trying to get a straight answer out of them, and ultimately A Night in Casablanca wound up not really actually being a parody of Casablanca at all. So Warner was happy, and Groucho later confessed to spreading the rumor that they objected to the title as a joke, and that generated some publicity for their movie. It's a hilarious letter, though, and we will definitely put the full text of that on our website, allmovietalk.com, so be sure to check that out. But that brings me to story number two, and it's also a dispute over a title. There's this campy B-movie from 1964 called The Incredibly Strange Creatures Who Stopped Living and Became Mixed-Up Zombies. It's a wonderful title, but the original title was going to be The Incredibly Strange Creature, or Why I Stopped Living and Became a Mixed-Up Zombie. But Columbia Pictures threatened to sue over the title, claiming it was too similar to their own forthcoming 1964 film, Dr. Strangelove, or How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Bomb. Now, the writer-director star of The Incredibly Strange Creatures, whose name was Ray Dennis Steckler, was just astonished that Columbia Pictures would feel threatened by this little film, but he suggested a new title, the one that, you know, didn't shamelessly plagiarize the word or, and the matter was dropped. Now, Stephen, is this story fact, fiction, or a little of both?
I have absolutely no idea.
Bizarrely, this story is absolutely true.
Wow, because, I mean, I definitely would have confused those two if they hadn't changed the title.
Yes. Well, my next story is about the 1962 film The Longest Day, an epic retelling of D-Day. Just before shooting, producer Daryl F. Zanuck was contacted by a man who said he represented the owners of the private beaches in Corsica that they were going to film on. Well, the man demanded payment of $15,000 to use the property, and if Zanuck didn't pay, they'd retaliate by driving modern cars all along the beach, thereby ruining any footage that they would shoot there. So Zanuck paid the man, and they got to shoot on location on this beach property. Well, later, it was discovered that there are no private beaches at all in Corsica. They're all public beaches, and Zanuck had been scammed. He eventually got his money back, but it took an 8-year lawsuit to do it. Stephen, is this story fact, fiction, or a little of both?
I'm going to go with fact.
You are correct. You're 2 for 2 with one abstention. Story number 4 about Clark Gable, one of the most popular leading men of his day and a certified box office draw. He was under contract to MGM, and when he got in a drunk driving accident, killing a pedestrian near Hollywood Boulevard, the studio head Louis B. Mayer took swift action to fend off his scandal and protect the star, who was, of course, one of the company's biggest fiscal assets. He had Gable ushered into hiding and paid a minor executive at the company to take the rap for the accident and actually go to jail for a little while, and he bribed the press into suppressing the story. Stephen, is this fact, fiction, or a little of both?
I think it's almost entirely fiction.
Yep, you are correct. It is cobbled together, though, from a bunch of different true stories. In 1945, Gable actually did run his vehicle into a tree while drunk, but there were no casualties. In 1933, 12 years earlier, John Huston, at the time an unknown, but later he became the director of the Maltese Falcon and played a key role in the movie Chinatown as an actor. But at the time, he was an unknown, but he was the son of Walter Huston, a very valuable star at the studio at the time. But anyway, John Huston did get into an automobile accident in 1933 that did result in a woman getting killed, but there doesn't seem to be any evidence that he was drunk or even at fault in the accident. And also in 1933, Gable was hospitalized for a while for the treatment of an infection. So if you take the fact that Gable was hospitalized around the same time some other actor was involved in an accident that killed somebody, and combine that with the 1945 story that Gable was drunk and hit a tree, well, then you get this dramatic story about Gable killing somebody and the studio covering it up. But the studios were powerful in that day, but I don't think they could have stopped a criminal investigation. It's just not true. And that brings me to my last story, which is about a much more recent movie. It seems that the Idaho State Legislature passed a resolution commending Jared and Jerusha Hess for writing and directing the film Napoleon Dynamite. And so the Idaho State Legislature passed a resolution commending them for showcasing the positive aspects of Idaho's youth, culture, educational system, athletics, economic prosperity, and diversity. The resolution stated in part, whereas any member of the House of Representatives or the Senate of the Legislature in the state of Ohio who choose to vote nay on this concurrent resolution are freaking idiots and run the risk of having the worst day of their lives. The resolution was passed by the House unanimously and was confirmed in the Senate by a voice vote. Stephen, is this story fact, fiction, or a little of both?
I think it's fact.
It is fact. It's 100% true. It was passed in 2005 and was House Concurrent Resolution number 29. On our website, we will post a link to the full text of the resolution as it appears on the official website for the state of Idaho. You know, some strange things happen in the government sometimes, but this shameless exhibition of a sense of humor really takes the cake.
One of the great joys in movies, at least since the invention of synchronized sound, has been the use of music in films, particularly, of course, in musicals. But what I want to talk about today in our top six list is movies that have great musical moments when the movies themselves are not musicals. This is
can be a great use of a soundtrack or music that comes from within the setting of the story, but in other words, just no musicals allowed. So let's just dive into it. You get an idea of what we're talking about here. My number six entry is the great film Apocalypse Now from 1979, and there's a couple interesting musical choices in this one, but in particular, probably the most famous scene from the film is the helicopter assault on the Vietnamese village, in which Captain Kilgore puts on Ride of the Valkyries by Wagner because it scares the heck out of the natives, and so you hear, you know, this great booming Wagner score over the sounds of helicopters and machine gun fire, and just a weird twisted image that shot of the helicopters flying as this song plays in the background, I think, is one of the most famous moments in film history, and a really memorable and evocative moment that pretty much sums up the sort of weird, twisted spirit of the film.
Yeah, that's a great choice. Well, I had a tough time with this because if you just pick all the musical moments in all films, that's a lot to choose from.
Sure is.
Even if you take out the musical. So I had a tough time, and I had to limit myself by not considering any soundtrack elements at all. The music had to come from the movie, the story, somehow. And my number six choice is from Deliverance in 1972. It's about a canoeing, camping kind of a trip gone way wrong. Very unpleasant, actually, but a pretty good thriller. Anyway, it starts off with these guys going through the woods to get to their put-in point, and they run across a bunch of people living out in the boonies, a bunch of hillbillies, scariest-looking people you can imagine. I mean, I had a turn and ran away at that moment, but I think this movie made people afraid of the woods, and there's really nothing to be afraid of. But anyway, they run across this village, and one of the people played by Ronnie Cox has a guitar, and he just starts strumming a little tune, and then it's answered by one of these locals on a banjo, and then so they kind of go back and forth for a little while, and then very famously kind of break out into a hoedown sort of a thing, but it's called Dueling Banjos, very famous piece. And I love the Wikipedia, I just looked this up on Wikipedia, I love the description of the other character who's in this village. It's Lonnie, I guess is his name. He's a mentally retarded, inbred, extremely gifted banjo player. So that pretty much sums up his entire role in that movie. But yeah, what a strange bit of atmosphere it creates for what's going to be a pretty unpleasant kind of a thriller, really. But you see a connection happening between these people who are initially very alienating and scary and unsettling, and suddenly you have this musical conversation between them. And so it just, I'm not sure what it does in the context of the movie, but just for this scene, it creates a really interesting relationship, atmosphere sort of a thing. I don't know how to describe it, but it's very, very riveting to watch. And good music, of course.
Absolutely. And one of those songs that's just completely famous now, it comes up all the time in pop culture. Well, a moment that I picked that's not from the score either, and strangely my only John Williams moment, is the climax of Close Encounters of the Third Kind, the great Steven Spielberg film from 1977. And it's a movie that's about aliens making contact with humans, and throughout the entire movie we don't really see aliens, we see the ships and some evidence of them, but there's this series of notes that keeps being left behind that the people who have had contact with them are become obsessed with, and it becomes sort of the at this end when the sort of the aliens make contact with humans on a large scale, the way that they communicate is through playing a progressively increasingly complicated series of these notes. It starts out with the same repeating notes, and then just gets this great huge finale as the alien ship flashes lights and tune with the music, and just a wonderful, just really, really magical moment that's sort of about trying to speak to somebody that is so completely alien to us they couldn't ever really speak with us. I love it because not only is it an interesting moment musically, but so often in the movies, aliens are just things that want to jump out and kill us, and this is a moment that I think rings true. This might be how, if we ever did contact another species, it might be like that.
Yeah, great choice there, too. Very memorable scene, largely because of the music. My number five choice is a number called Put the Blame on Mame from the 1946 film Gilda, performed by Rita Hayworth. It's famously described as a striptease where all she removes is a glove, and the performance is amazing because you're watching this old movie, you know it's going to be past the censors and everything, so it's not going to be too risque, but and you watch it and you think, oh my goodness, she's removing a glove, and then you realize, oh, it's a glove, you know. Testament to the performance by Rita Hayworth, but it comes in an interesting context in the movie, too. She's basically being chased by a couple of guys, not really chased, but people are certainly out to get her in some way, and there's been some reciprocation on that too. She kind of deserves it. But anyway, she finds refuge on stage and suddenly and just starts performing the song, and how completely she gets into performing the song. It's just it's like flipping a switch on her personality. She suddenly switches from clashing with this other character, suddenly she's on stage and is able to put all that behind her, and it really drives home how quickly she can just turn things off and turn things on and become a different person. And it makes you wonder how honest she's been, frankly. And she's certainly a gifted actress. So great song, great scene, and great context within the movie.
Yeah, that's a great moment. I wish I had thought of it. I might have included it. But I don't know. Like you said, a lot of great moments. My list was, you know, dozens of items until I finally had to trim it to six. But my number four pick is really a sentimental favorite for me just because I love this movie so much. And it's a sequence from Almost Famous, the great Cameron Crowe movie from 2000 that's all about rock and roll music in the early 70s, based on, of course, Crowe's life, in which he actually, as a teenager, wrote for Rolling Stone and traveled around with bands and stuff. And so our protagonist in this film is the stand-in for Crowe, and he's this kid who's like 15 years old and traveling around with this fictional rock band. He loves music and he loves rock and roll, but he's becoming disillusioned hanging with all these dysfunctional people who are, you know, using drugs and drinking and fighting over stupid little petty things. And, you know, he wants to go home. He just wants to leave. And he's on this bus after spending the night with the lead guitarist from the band. And they're on the bus and they're leaving. He just wants to be home. And everyone's just sitting there and everyone's bummed out. And on the soundtrack of the bus, the sound system comes on Tiny Dancer by Elton John, and, you know, a couple of people just start sort of singing along with it, and by the end of it, the entire bus is singing along, and it's a moment that just strikes you how powerful even pop music can be, even something, you know, like rock and roll, you don't necessarily think of as being powerful, classical music, but here's a moment where it really can, and it's really just topped off when the kid says, you know, I need to go home, and the Kate Hudson character just looks around and says, you are home, and it's just a wonderful, wonderful moment with a really, really great song, Tiny Dancer, one of Elton John's best performances.
I think a number of the best uses of music in movies come from people spontaneously just kind of gradually coming out with some kind of a song. Of course, a lot of the worst are like that too, but yeah, music is something that joins us together. We all sort of relate to music, even if we don't in other ways, and so to see people coming together, even if it's just to sing a particular song off-key or whatever, these moments sometimes can feel very authentic and moving. My number four choice, I think the most fun rendition of a Cole Porter song in any movie comes from a very unlikely place, and that would be the very beginning of Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom from 1984.
Ooh, yeah.
It is the number Anything Goes, probably my favorite song from that era even, sung in Mandarin, except for the refrain, Anything Goes. It's something that really creates a great atmosphere. I don't know that it affects the plot and character arcs too much, but it really sets a great mood for this particular scene that happens early on in the film.
Yeah, that's great. That's a good choice. Well, my number three pick is something that is just on the soundtrack, not actually featured in the film. One of my two choices like that. And it's the Gonna Fly Now sequence from the original Rocky from 1976. The song, of course, the famous Rocky theme song by Bill Conti. And it comes at an interesting point in time. I recently watched Rocky again after discussions about Rocky Balboa, and I was surprised because the way I remembered it was incorrect. There are actually two real big training sequences in Rocky. The first is right after he accepts the fight with Apollo Creed, you know, the big heavyweight champ, and he goes out running early in the morning, and a different song plays over the soundtrack. It's kind of a low-key, sad song as, you know, Rocky's just running through the streets of Philadelphia right before dawn, and he's not quite in shape. He's past his prime, a little over the hill maybe, and then we see some more scenes, and then the final training sequence, right before he's ready to go fight, he gets out there and starts running, and he's inspired, and then we hear that great Bill Conti music just overcoming everything, and we see him run up the steps, of course, the famous, famous scene where Rocky runs up the steps of the Philadelphia Art Museum and looks to the east over the skyline of the city and puts his hands in the air above him, and it's just a wonderful revelatory moment, just this great, great training sequence. And when you see that, you're like, yes, I identify with this character, I want to be him, and you almost feel for a second like anything is possible. Now, of course, also wonderfully is the way that this song comes back a little bit later in the movie, and it's going to play over the big climactic fight between Apollo and Rocky. But the training sequence, the second training sequence, that when we first hear this music, is just wonderful. One of the most famous movie moments and a great, great, great sequence.
You know what's a testament to how enduring this is it's been parodied. This moment was he's running up the steps and the music and everything. It's been parodied so much since 1976.
Absolutely.
And yet, if you watch the original movie, it still works. It still has that emotional impact. Yeah. A testament to the music and the scene.
And I defy you to hear that song and not want to throw your hands into the air and start jumping up and down.
Yeah, yeah, right. Well, my number three choice illustrates how context can really alter the impact of a piece of music. And it's from the Alfred Hitchcock film The Man Who Knew Too Much, the 1956 version. This would be Hitchcock's remake of his own film from the 30s. But the climax of the film involves a concert with an orchestra, and an orchestra's playing, and there's a particular moment in the music. There's going to be a crescendo and a clash of cymbals, and at that moment, that's when a gunshot is going to be fired, and the crescendo is going to mask the sound of the bullet. So that's a premise, and we know this is going to happen, and then eventually it starts to happen. It's almost like having the red digital readout with the seconds ticked down to when the bomb explodes, except the key difference here is we don't really know how many seconds. We're always strained to hear the bit of music that we recognize that is going to be the precursor to the crescendo. So all while this music is playing and things are happening inside and outside the concert hall at this time, and if they're outside, we still hear a bit of the music on the soundtrack, just maybe muted a little. But we're listening to the music, and it's very ominous. Normally, it'd be very pleasant music to listen to, you know, the fun, dramatic kind of thing. But this is very ominous now because somebody is going to die, and there's going to be a catastrophe at a key moment in the music. So we're listening to this, waiting for that little bit we recognize, and maybe we think we do, and then, you know, we don't. It's not like the digital readout where we always know exactly how many seconds are left. Such a fantastic use of music. Very inspired to use a musical piece as your countdown. But that's how it works, and it makes a great suspenseful scene.
Absolutely. Hitchcock, particularly good with music, along with his longtime composer, Bernard Herrmann. And Herrmann scored that as well, that film. They did a great job together. And I could have picked a couple of different Hitchcock moments. I thought really strongly about the great Stings from Psycho, just a wonderful bit that's been copied. But too many to pick from.
Yes.
Well, my number two pick may be perhaps one of the most definitive soundtrack moments in all film, and it's the opening of 2001 A Space Odyssey, the 1968 Stanley Kubrick movie, where we see a day dawning from space. We see the Earth sort of turning in the sun as we hear the first couple notes of Also Spoke Zarathustra by Richard Strauss. If you hear those, the first four or five notes, if you hear them, you'll immediately think, even if you haven't seen 2001, I guarantee you'll sort of think of like great momentous things, because that's what the song makes you think of. And in the movie, it works so wonderfully well because it introduces us that this is going to be a movie that's going to be about something big. It's going to be weighty and a little pretentious even. Certainly that's the way 2001 is, but what a wonderful opening. Of course, the movie had a score originally written for it, an original score, but Kubrick, while working on the film, played a lot of just classical music and opera and that kind of stuff, and decided to largely throw out the original score, and so he got this piece and a lot of other just famous pieces throughout the film just placed in instead of original music. And I think, you know, I can't imagine 2001 without the music at all, especially important because, you know, something like almost an hour and a half the movie has no dialogue. I don't know if it's quite that long, but it seems that way. So a lot of the movie is just music and images, and a wonderful, wonderful way to start this movie.
Yeah, great choice there, too. It's certainly a very iconic moment as the Rocky one. I think the Rocky one's a little more fun, but anyway. My number two is very interesting moment. It's sort of almost like the Cold War in one room. We have the Marseillaise being sung, the French national anthem being sung by a bunch of patriots in the movie Casablanca from 1942, and they start doing this to drown out the Germans singing their anthem. So we have sort of a musical battle happening here, and I think the scene works because this is genuine for a lot of the people. A lot of the people who brought in to be extras in this movie and sing it really did feel the emotion of the moment here. And when you watch the movie, you'll see a few people breaking out into tears. Apparently, these were legitimate. This wasn't acting. This actually happened in the room at the time. And I think that the power of that emotion really comes through when you watch the movie.
Okay, so of all the moments to choose from in movie music history, you had to pick my number one for your number two?
Yeah, sorry.
Good for you. And you know, I think a lot of people, when they think of Casablanca, would have picked As Time Goes By. It's played so often throughout the film. It's sort of the movie's theme. But I have to think that this is perhaps the best all-time great musical moment in a movie that's not actually a musical. Like you said, we have the Nazi soldiers as they start singing Deutschland über alles, and then there's that moment where the band wants to strike up the French national anthem, and they look at Humphrey Bogart, who's sort of been playing both sides. He's trying to remain neutral because they're in Free French Morocco, where the Nazis are basically controlling things, and you know France itself is occupied, and so Rick, this is where I think he really makes a decision, and he says, "Yeah, go ahead. We're gonna drown out the Nazis, and we're gonna play the French national anthem." And it's such a wonderful, powerful scene, inspired by a very similar scene in the World War I film Grand Illusion, where French soldiers who are being held in a German POW camp break out into the song at the news of a French victory, sort of in defiance of their captors. And here it takes on so much more because I think, you know, the one thing Casablanca does so well is make us identify with the Humphrey Bogart character, and this is where he really chooses a side. It's one of those things where it makes you feel inspired as though you're the one standing up, and this is just, you know, the way to show it to the Nazis and that we're going to stand up and fight for what we believe in, and that's sort of where Rick, I think, makes his decision to do the same thing, which he'll end up doing by the end of the film.
Yeah, so very key moment in the movie, as well as a great musical moment, very powerful and everything. Yeah, I actually guessed that you picked it for number one right after I said what it was, because you didn't react at all. And I'm like, oh no, he's smoldering. I picked his number one.
Yeah, I sure was.
And you'll probably be smoldering even more when you find out my number one choice. Yeah, it's from a Laurel and Hardy movie from 1937 called Way Out West. These people are not remembered very well, I don't think. They're kind of lumped in with, I don't know, the Three Stooges or whatever kind of goofs there are. Actually, Oliver Hardy was quite a good singer. He had a great tenor voice, and he starts singing a song called On the Trail of the Lonesome Pine. Very great song. And the first half of it is just him singing it, and it wasn't usual. A lot of comedies from that time would just break out in songs here and there to kind of break up the comedy, and they're sort of unwelcome now. But these two people were not known for that. But there was this song in this one movie, and then the second half is when Stan Laurel joins in, and his voice is unnaturally deep, and obviously it was dubbed later, but it is very well lip-synced, so there's a bit of comedy there, and Oliver just kind of looks over at him and says, why are you singing so deep? And of course that annoys him, because Oliver Hardy is just generally annoyed by Stan Laurel. And then the scene progresses from there, and they continue to play with the idea of Stan Laurel having this unnatural voice. But a very great scene and great song, too.
Okay, well, let's go ahead and recap, since I'm still... smoldering is a good word to describe how I feel after Sam rips off my first pick. Anyway, my number six entry is Apocalypse Now, the Rite of the Valkyries sequence. My number five is the climax to Close Encounters of the Third Kind, with a great score by John Williams there. Number four is Almost Famous, the song Tiny Dancer by Elton John. Number three, Bill Conti's Gonna Fly Now song from Rocky. Number two, the Richard Strauss piece Also Spoke Zarathustra from 2001, A Space Odyssey. And number one, the singing of the La Marseillaise, boy my French sucks, from Casablanca.
And my number six, Dueling Banjos from Deliverance in 1972. Number five, Put the Blame on Mame from Gilda, 1946. Number four, Anything Goes in Mandarin, sung in the beginning of Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom in 1984. Number three, The Crescendo from The Man Who Knew Too Much, the 1956 version. Number two, La Marseillaise, the French national anthem from Casablanca in 1942, and number one, On the Trail of the Lonesome Pine from Way Out West in 1937.
Well, it's time for another entry in our Film Buffs Dictionary. Last time we covered pan and tilt, two ways of moving the camera around without actually moving the base of the camera, and today we're going to cover zoom. This is, of course, a way of, once again, adjusting our point of view without actually moving the camera. Now, just to give you a basic idea, the zoom itself is a special lens whose focal length can be adjusted. And the focal length, without getting too technical, it basically determines whether or not you're seeing a wide shot or a more narrow shot. Of course, wide shots, you get more things in the frame at once, but it also tends to make distant objects look more distant. Narrower shots make further objects look closer.
Now, the important thing about a zoom lens is it's a lens that can actually adjust. For about the first half of movie making, up through the 1960s or so, if a director or a cinematographer wanted to change the sort of lens they were using, they had to actually stop the film and use a different lens that was either wider or narrower, shorter or longer, basically. The zoom lens, when it was introduced in the 1960s, actually allows directors to change the focal length within a single shot. So you don't actually have to cut between changing it. We can zoom in or zoom out. And really in the 1970s, they really got their due. In 1970s American film, zooms become very, very prominent. And of course, in addition to just being the noun, the zoom lens, zoom can also be a verb. It means to either move in or move out, zoom in or zoom out. So if you're going narrower, you're zooming in, making things look closer. If you're zooming out, you're going wider, making things look a little further away. Now, again, the main use, of course, is just to make distant things appear closer, but there's a couple other important things that it does. One is it changes the depth of field. Wide angles tend to give you larger depth of field, which means that more things are in focus at once. If you're really wide-angle lenses, you tend to get really large depth of field where everything appears to be in focus, and it becomes very difficult to tell how far apart things are. If you zoom in really close to something, however, just that object is in focus, and everything else tends to be out of focus. This is partially an effect of the actual physical way that zooms work and that different focal length lenses work, but of course there is an aesthetic use for this too. And the zoom is generally a very showy kind of move. We talk about maybe pans or tilts, for instance, not being very showy, whereas, say, a crane shot is very showy. A zoom also is very showy. And, of course, if you combine it with other showy camera moves, say a crane shot and then a zoom, it becomes a very sort of extravagant look to it. It has a very documentary feel to it. Documentaries, of course, love the zoom lens because documentarians cannot predefine shots and composition, so if they want to adjust the focal length, they have to do it always on the fly, and maybe something happens off in the distance, they got to zoom in. So if you watch a lot of documentaries, you see zooms all the time. For instance, the director Robert Altman used it all the time in his sort of improvisational documentary-esque films. He was a big fan of the zoom because it gives you that sort of improvisational feel. If you've seen it a lot on TV nowadays, but it's a lot of sort of trying to make things look like documentaries, the science fiction film Serenity from 2005 used zooms in space combat scenes, which of course certainly started as the television show Firefly, but I think probably a lot of our listeners have seen that movie, and it's interesting there because they're trying to make it look like a documentary, so how do you, obviously any scene in space isn't filmed on a set, that's all done with computers, but you add in fake zooms and it becomes kind of an interesting look to it. But it also, the zoom can also be used to let us know what people are thinking. For instance, Stanley Kubrick loved to zoom in on faces. You start with an actor, and then you sort of just zoom in on the guy's face, and you get a real close shot of his face, and it gives us, we get the sense that, okay, this person is thinking something, and the emotional context of that scene gives us an idea of what he's thinking. Kubrick, you know, just absolutely the master of using faces and showing real close shots on faces.
You sure those aren't tracking in?
Some are. Somebody also use a lot of zooms. Because, of course, with the zoom gives you the real neat effect where everything else goes out of focus except just the object that you have because you just lose all that depth of field. Whereas that, you know, a push-in doesn't give you the same thing. Another great use of the zoom is to distinguish one thing from among a lot of things. A classic example of this is you have, say, a really wide shot from a height or something of a crowd scene. And the 1970s film The Conversation by Francis Ford Coppola has a really famous opening shot, which is this shot of just you know, big crowd of people as the sound recording technician who's moving his microphones around listening to what they're saying. And as we're listening to various conversations, you know, we're slowly zooming in on specific people. And so by the time this long shot's over, we're sort of stuck on this character we're supposed to be paying attention to. And it's interesting because you start off, you get this whole sense of this is a whole bunch of people, but then we can zoom in on just the one thing and it really draws attention and highlights that particular thing. One film book I read compared the zoom sort of to the old Irish shot. They use a lot of silent films where everything goes black except for a circle where you see exactly what the director wants us to see, or think of it as a spotlight on a stage. We're drawing attention to one very specific kind of thing.
I think a lot of inexperienced filmmakers overuse the zoom, and definitely people who are fooling around with their video cameras trying to make home movies, you know, look at, definitely overuse the zoom. I think it's important to note a key difference between a zoom, like if you're zooming in on something versus tracking in on something. And that is that a push-in more accurately simulates what the human eye is going to see. If we move closer to something, what we see is what a push-in will give us, or a tracking shot. If we zoom in, the way the depth of field works, the way how the background, you know, doesn't really retain the proper sense of depth to it and everything else, that does not feel like the human eye. So sometimes zoom shots are used very nicely when you're getting a camera's eye view of a shot. If there's an actual camera in a movie, you know, a security camera or something, we see through the camera and the camera zooms in, that's okay because that gives us a simulation of what a camera sees. But if we want to have a person approaching somebody and we want to have a point of view shot for that person, don't use the zoom. It's not going to feel like the guy is moving towards somebody and seeing it more closely. So that's kind of interesting that when you see a push-in shot and a zoom-in shot, it's hard to see, oh, this is why it looks that way. And yet the human brain can identify the difference in a pinch.
Yeah, because obviously the human eye does not have zoom capabilities.
It would be neat if it did, though.
Absolutely, I agree 100%.
So this week's trivia question, as we mentioned earlier, is to give the real name of Mahatma Kane Jeeves, the pseudonym used to credit the screenwriter of The Bank Dick, starring W.C. Fields, a great classic slapstick comedy. Stephen, do you have a guess for this?
Is it W.C. Fields?
Oh, you're right! It is, in fact, W.C. Fields himself. He wrote the screenplay, and it's a play on words. My hat, my cane, Jeeves. A line that recalls old stage plays about aristocrats. Anyway, Fields enjoyed using comic pseudonyms like Otis Cribble Cobless, and character names, too, for that matter, like Larson E. Whipsnade from You Can't Cheat an Honest Man. Get it, Larson E.? Get it? Anyway, The Bank Dick is a devious little comedy and also a nice lesson for working around censors. Initially, the censors at Universal rejected his script and demanded a bunch of changes, but the director, Eddie Klein, said, well, let's just film it our way because they won't even notice the difference by the time we're done. And sure enough, they did not.
So that wraps things up for this week. Be sure and, of course, check out our website, allmovietalk.com. That's the name of the show, allmovietalk.com. We'll have lots of great discussions and break down show notes for each episode. We'll provide links and extra information about the stuff we've talked about.
And also check out rinkworks.com, an entertainment website with a bunch of movie-related features as well as other things. Next week, pretty good stuff going on. We'll continue our discussion of German Expressionism, sort of, by talking about film noir, a genre that was descended from German Expressionism. And if you remember way back when Steven taught us all about how to survive an action movie, well, he's back, and this time he's going to tell us how to pull off a caper. The top six list, if you want to think about what your choices for your list would be, we're going to talk about distinctly different sequels. Sequels to movies that are just nothing like the originals. Cut, 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 cut.